and just kind of forget that it's there, if that's possible. Okay, and, oh, I probably should have done this before turning it on, but that's fine. Kim should have emailed you a release form. Did you
have
time to look
it, that
over?
But there's no problem. I could sign it.
Okay, we can do that after.
Yeah,
if
sure.
Like. Okay.
It will not be an issue at all.
Okay, well, we'll make sure you have the time to look
okay.
It over. Okay. So first, now that we're on a separate recording, why don't you state your name, date of birth, your role here at Wayne
sure.
State?
My name is Anthony Holt. The spelling of the last name is H-O-L-T. I was born November 23rd, 1966. I started here as an officer in April 17th, 1977, after graduating from the Detroit Police Academy. I worked myself up through the ranks here. I became chief in 2008, and my current position is Associate Vice President of the University and Chief of Police.
Excellent. And could we get, I'd like to start with a bit of background on you and your history in the Detroit area.
I was actually born in Chicago, but my family moved here at a very early age, and we have been lifelong Detroiters. I've seen every transformation that you could really have or you could experience in the city of Detroit. I went to Northwestern High School. I lived on West Grand Boulevard in Detroit. I lived on a couple blocks where the Motown Museum was Hittsville. And I bring that up because my father had my brother since he was 4 years old playing piano. And when he was about 13 or 14, because we lived a couple blocks from Hittsville, which was, they didn't call it Hittsville then, it was the Motown recording studio. All the musicians that would go in there couldn't really read or write music, and they would come to our house and he would sing a melody and he would write the tunes down or write the notes to it. I bring it up because all those famous artists years ago used to come into our house. My father was a real big community activist. Some of the early freedom marches, Martin Luther King and some of the early people in the movements would come to our house and they would stay there because at that time there was not a lot of hotels available for African Americans that they could stay in. And I can remember, I always get ticked because we have to leave our bedroom and turn it over to someone else. So I graduated from Northwestern High School when I was 16. And I got admitted to Wayne State in 1966. And I immediately moved on campus. I lived on Prentice Street, 700 Prentice, right there at Prentice at 3rd. And that's when it wasn't called Midtown, it was called the Cass Corridor. And of course, I needed a job to support myself. And I got a job at a gas station on 2nd and Alexandria, right in the heart of the Cass Corridor. So I saw all the drug dealers, I saw the prostitutes, I saw the robbers. I lived next door to the gas station I worked at was next door to a halfway house. Mm-hmm. Of course, at 16, in that environment, it was very exciting. And, you know, I lived at 700 Prentice. And I lived right next door to this little garage where these rock groups, the MC5, the Amboy Dukes, these guys all became famous later, were practiced there. Bob Seger was a part of this group. And in this apartment I lived right next door to John St. Clair, who was the big marijuana hippie at that time. And those guys really sort of looked out for me.
What years did you live at the...
I moved there in June of 1966. That building is no longer there now. It's part of the Calumet townhouses.
And before 66, before you started...
The address I lived there, I'll never forget, at 1712 West Grand Boulevard. It was a big, huge house on West Grand Boulevard. And it's beautiful. The parks were there. I lived right across the street from the fire station.
And that's where you lived with your
parents?
With
my parents till 1966. Mm-hmm.
And you moved there from Chicago?
We moved from Chicago. We moved in a different neighborhood of Detroit. We lived on a street called 24th Street.
Okay.
If you drive down those areas now, you would think you're in Beirut or one of the Middle Eastern countries that have been bombed out. The areas are vacant. The houses are torn down. It was a very vibrant neighborhood. I lived on 24th and McGraw growing up. You know, real strong block club organizations. It reminds me of what Midtown is doing now with organizing. But the block clubs were real strong. Neighbors would come out there and correct you while you're walking to school if you did anything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And you dare not get in trouble because they would tell your parents so you'd be in bigger trouble. Very, very strong neighborhood associations at that time. There were gangs, but there were neighborhood gangs, not turf gangs where you'd be beat up if you didn't go into that area. And like I say, I lived there, and then we moved to the Boulevard in there, 1961. Huge home. And I remember because we had, at that time, you had coal furnaces. And my job was to wake up and to start the fire and shovel the coal in the furnace. And then virtually they retrofitted them to gas furnaces. And I lived there until I started at Wayne State. At 16, it was quite an awakening to come from my high school, inner city high school, and start college at 16. It's this big awakening. I don't think the schools at that time really prepared you for colleges like they really don't do now. We get a lot of kids who come to Wayne from some of the schools in Detroit, and they're not really prepared to do the work. That's why I think our rate is so high in terms of retaining these type of students.
And was that typical starting at 16?
No, what happened is I grew up in a family where my father believed that education was the key to everything. So you could not spend the summers, have the summer off. I don't think you could do that anymore in the public schools. Back when I was going to school, during the summer when school was recessed, if you take three classes, you take an English, math, and a government class, you come out a grade ahead. Mm-hmm. So what they did was really, if you think about it, very unfair. They had me go to school every summer, so I advanced a grade. Actually 15 when I actually graduated, but okay. I was 16 when I started at Wayne. That does not prepare you for college. It's a good bragging rights for your parents to say, my son is 15 and he graduated from high school, but it does not prepare you academically for college, and it does not prepare you socially to intermerse with people. You don't really have your peer group. And what it causes you to do is actually fabricate your age so you sort of fit in. Mm-hmm. You know, I really couldn't get a job at 15 to 16. I would use my brother's birth certificate, and I got hired at Chrysler's during the summer at 16. And God, I worked at Chrysler's when I was 16, and I worked a day shift. I would get off on the day shift and get the Jefferson bus and drive down to McLeod Steel and work another shift at 16.
In factory work.
Factory work. Mm-hmm. To save money for the upcoming season in college. I mean, I remember it like yesterday because I bought my first car for $350. And you know, it was just an exciting time when you were 16.
Sure, and then that's while you were living, when you came to school, you were living in the Cass Corridor.
I was living in the Cass Corridor, living at 700 Prentice. And my neighbor at that time was Fred's Key Shop. He had a little corner shop on the corner of Forest and 3rd. And now he's down there on 2nd and Merle. I still go down there and talk to him. We talk about those days there.
Were you living in university housing?
Oh, there was no university housing. Wayne State didn't really have, they had a women's dorm at that time, but there was no university housing. You found an apartment in a corridor. That was the closest I could get to the university that I could afford. It appeared somewhat safe.
And you mentioned when you moved down here that it was really different and that there were a lot of gangs and there was drugs.
No, Cass Corridor was a pretty much still, it was a diverse area, but it's pretty much still a white area. Okay. You had, along 3rd Avenue where I live, you had the Anderson Show Bar, you had the Willis Show Bar, you had Jumbo's and Garrett's. On the west side of the street, those bars like the Golden Ducket and the Garrett Lounge were drug bars where the drug dealers and the players hung out. The Anderson Show Bar, the Willis Show Bar were big prostitution show bars. Cass Corridor was basically known for prostitution. Buses would come over from Canada. That was a big draw for conventions to be in that area. Mm-hmm. There were thieves and robbers, but it was not a lot of trouble. I mean, people flocked to the area because it was like a red light district. Mm-hmm. You know, so Canfield was still a very nice street at that time, but when you left that area, the further south you went. And the further south you went, once you crossed Myrtle or Mac, that's when they used to call them the flop houses, or the halfway houses, the shelters, the rehab places. So just an inspiration of people. you know, 12, 1 o'clock at night, it's just people walking all over the place.
So what were your early experiences as a student at Wayne State like with crime and law enforcement?
You know, there was really no crime that I could speak of at Wayne State. Wayne State was a commuter school. Most people worked who went there. At 16 years old, it was very, very difficult to fit in. You know, I had a lot of trouble the first year class-wise academically. You know, the embarrassment of not doing well and going home just meant you could not fail. So then I quit my part-time job just to concentrate on studies. Racially, it was a very tough place because it was not the diversity that you have now. Very, very low. And then the following year in 1967 is when we had the riots or the disturbance. And that created even a bigger gap at that time. So the first year was very, very difficult trying to fit in. I got accepted to 4 schools. But financially, I did not want to ask my parents to do a lot. My father was a factory worker. My mother was a housewife. I had an older brother in New Mexico State. So I did not want to text them. I said, well, I could pay for this myself. But it was a very first year adjustment-wise. It was very, very tough.
And you paid for school out of pocket?
I paid for everything out of pocket. I worked the factory jobs in the summer. I worked part-time jobs. You could do that then. I think my tuition was $104 for 3 classes.
So what did you end up majoring in while you were at Wayne State?
I majored in psychology when I first started here. No, I did be a police officer at that time. I actually wanted to become a social worker. And I think the reason why is that while I was walking around the class sort of lost, I met this lady and she says, you look lost and I'm lost too. I'm trying to find this building. And she was the instructor of this class I was going to. And her name was Phyllis Varun. She became the interim president of Wayne State. She became the dean of social worker. She just retired last year. She became the dean of social worker. Then she became the interim provost. And when President Noreen left the university several years ago, they made her the interim president. Then when they hired the president right before this president, Gilmore, he asked her to become the deputy president. And through my entire career at Wayne, she was like a big mentor to me. Gave me a great deal of help. Then I met this other professor, Arthur Johnson. He's just a legendary civil rights pioneer. He taught race relations, which I took. He was president of the NAACP. And he sort of got me involved. And I think 2 strong mentors like that really helped me get past that first year. And once I got past that first year, you know, I was on my way. Wayne State typical grad graduates in 6 years. My father said, you know, 4 years you go to school, maybe not. Mm-hmm. And this was the era of the Vietnam War. If you were not at school, you were going to be drafted.
Right.
So it was a very turbulent year, but it was very exciting outside of the university. The university, to me, was very cold, very antisociable. You know, I was not the fraternity type guy because I was too young. And I wasn't in the dating scene because I was too young. You know, I barely had a driver's license. So it was a very difficult area socially to fit in. Yeah. So like I said, that first year was very, very tough.
You mentioned briefly, like in passing, you mentioned riots. And I'm curious, a lot of historians who study race relations, I mean, especially in this area, in the second half of the 20th century, a lot of these historians make the argument that the term race riots...
It was not a race riot.
I'm just curious,
it was a civil disturbance,
branching off
yeah.
of that. A lot of historians make the argument that the term riot, and especially in the context of race riots in this area, should actually be referred to as, racial revolutions or revolutionary disturbances.
Well, you know, in the 60s, when I was going here, what was exciting, Wayne State was a hub of activity in mm-hmm. terms of protests.
Right.
There was protests against the Vietnam War, and we had the onset of the Black Panthers. That was really something. In fact, I joined the party unofficially for a week. That was very impressive to see these black guys with black leather jackets bandoliers at his shoulders. When the police pulled somebody over, they got out the car and stood their grounds. Mm-hmm. Police was very, very brutal back in the early 60s. They had a crew called the Big Four. I know I worked 2 factory jobs, and I must have had $700 in my pocket. That's a lot of money even today for a 60-year-old kid to have. And I had a 1961 Chevrolet Bel Air that I paid $354. I kept it really clean. I got pulled over by this group called the Big Four. It was 1 uniform officer, 3 plainclothes officers. Huge guys. You know, I grew up to be, you know, very respectful adults. Had no attitude at all. I know they pulled me out the car, searched me, took the money out, and said I fit the description of someone just robbed the store. I mean, I could have had a heart attack right then. But then they found my paycheck stubs, the receipt where I bought the car, they let me go. That experience stuck with me till this day. I remember the guy put me on a car and says, if one finger come off that car, we're going to drop you. And I said, Jesus. I think I almost defecated on myself. Because I've never ever been in trouble, never ever had police contact whatsoever. It's very frightening. I mean, I've seen police really do a number of jobs of people in terms of beating them up. Right. And actually, the rebellion that I called it started in 1967, happened on 12th Street at Claremont in Detroit. 12th Street, you know, prior to me growing up, they had what's called Black Bottom at Hastings Street. I was too young to actually see it and be part of it, but 12th Street, I could center like that. 12th Street in the black community was a major strip. It started at West Grand Boulevard and 12th and went all the way down to, I would say, Davison. That was the strip. There were the after-hour places. There was a recreation area for the black community. You always see a lot of people on the street. They have the after-hour clubs. Well, you had the big performers play here. After they left their performances, they would go to these after-hour clubs. I know I was on 12th Street, you know, walking around. And then at midnight, the police vice shooter raided a blind pig there. That's what they called the after-hour places back then. And they were pretty safe. It was mostly liquor. I never saw a lot of drugs in them. I went in one a couple of times. You could buy liquor. And you listen to the music. There was prostitution in there probably, but I was too young to really recognize it. And the police raided it. And back then, when if you give any kind of resistance to the police, you better get thumped pretty good. But this particular night, it was like 90 degrees outside, a lot of people on the street. And this was the area of the H. Rep. Brown and the Stokely Carmichaels. And so The Black Revolution, as I call it, was just beginning to take place. You know, that's when the big afros came out, and the dashikis, and this identity of who you are. And, you know, I grew up in high school never knowing anything about black history. Not even knew we were part of history. And I thought that was pretty amazing 10 years later. You know, I knew nothing about anything. I was never taught anything about history here in terms of how African Americans fit in. And it just, the tension was always building, it just sort of blew when the police. It was more of a rebellion against police brutality at that time. And it just spiraled out of control. Somebody threw a brick in a police car, they set it on fire, and then all of a sudden the looting started. And I mean, it was just amazing to see people, you know, people were writing on the store Soul Brothers. Owned by a soul brother, meaning it's a black-owned store, do not break into it. People did not care. And what was very, when people call it a race riot, I took pictures. I still have some of those pictures of these days. It was black and white looting together. It was a free-for-all. Hmm. They broke into pawn shops. Most of the stores on 12th Street was a Jewish area. If you look at the history of Detroit, the African Americans always follows the Jewish migration. You know, we lived in an area that was strictly Jewish at one time. All the little grocery stores I worked into were owned by Jewish people. And they just treated me great. You know, I have friends from this day. And then 12th Street was all basically Jewish merchants. That area of Dexter and what they call Russell Woods was all Jewish area. And it was their stores that they looted, that they just cleaned them out. And it just spiraled out of control. The police could not handle it. They were not trained for this sort of insurrection. Like today, we have all these special response units. Back then, they had the riot squad. They just grabbed these big, tall guys who worked downtown and the beat officers. They give them big sticks and helmets, and they put them in to break up the crowds, but that wasn't working. Then H. Rep. Brown came in and did a speech on top of a building and says, "Burn, baby, burn," and the people got a sense. But what people don't realize, there was many whites and blacks in that crowd. I never saw in terms where they saw a white person, they were dragging them off the car. I never saw that at all. I just saw it was, people says, "God, it's a free-for-all now. Let's break in, let's get this." You know, people falling down trying to carry a refrigerator out the appliance store. You know, back then in the 60s, everything you needed to purchase was in the community. There were sporty goods shops, there were appliance shops, there were furniture, clothing stores. You don't have this in the black community now. And that era sort of destroyed that. This 1967 is what people refer to as the white flight. Because immediately, that Jewish area, they left. They left here, they went towards Oak Park. That was the next migration. And from Oak Park, they went to Southfield. From Southfield to West Bloomfield, not to Bloomfield. That was their migration. They left. And it never rebuilt. It never came back. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that caused that white flight. I know Belle Isle, everybody talk about how beautiful Belle Isle was. I remember what they did. The police were arresting people. They just, if you were on the street, they were just grabbing you. They're throwing you in a bus. And they took the elephant house of Belle Isle and they put chicken wire fence around it and lashed the prisoners. And I know one of my first assignments, writing assignments I had in Wayne State was to interview this judge, George Crockett. And I had a great deal of respect for him because the judge, he went to the precinct and he ordered the release of all these people that they were just grabbing and locking up. I stayed in this courtroom for a week, and I'm just amazed at how he was a civil rights activist who became a judge. And I watched him work, and it just had a profound effect on me. At that time, I said, you know, I want to become a police officer.
Is that where the turning point was?
I used to go to these Black Panthers meetings, but you know, it was more show and tell. You know, it wasn't what I thought it was. And I say, well, this doesn't really not work for me. And when I worked at Chrysler during the summer, I joined the Revolutionary Workers League. But them guys were getting fired left and right. So I said, ooh. I had the type of family you couldn't go home and say you lost your job because you participated in something.
It's a pretty big step from going from being a Panther, you know.
It's just a week. They asked me to write an article, and I just never did it, and never returned. You know.
So you graduated with a degree in social work.
I graduated with a degree in psychology. I graduated in 1970. Mm-hmm. It was not a bachelor's degree in social work, only a master's degree. Mm-hmm. But I says no. I took a job right after that. I worked for the Detroit Urban League for a while as an organizer in the neighborhoods. Didn't pay any money. But what happens, a lot of organizers, you work on the areas that are easiest. You don't really, you organize the people who are already organized. Mm-hmm. It'd be much better when you go out and you work in the areas that really need it and you try to convince people this is what you need to do. But, you know, you sort of take the easy way out. The areas are already organized. You just go there and give them more structure. I didn't really think I was making a difference then at all.
So how did you get from that to working with
the police? I took another stop. I got very frustrated with the social services. I said, boy, I'm not going to make any money. I'm not really doing any good. Family expectation was that once you got the college degree, the whole world opens up. But, you know, it doesn't. I don't blame my parents. You know, very old school from the South. But it does not work that way. And I took a job with Xerox Corporation. And I didn't roll well as a salesperson. And I left Xerox. I worked with Sears.
In sales?
Yeah. No, I worked executive management program. They sent me to Chicago. They grew me to become a store manager. But I hated it. And then I applied to Wayne State Police Department in 1977. And got hired as an officer.
Without returning to school for criminal justice or anything like
that? No, at that time, all you needed, Wayne State was only the second school in the country to require a bachelor's degree.
Hmm.
I said, boy, this is much more professional. And they were all commissioned as Detroit police officers.
Yeah.
And we got pictures on the walls out here in the early stages of what we did. So I said, this is what I want to do. I says, I'm working with a professional place. Everybody has their degrees. I won't have the racial hostility that you saw in Detroit. Mm-hmm. He said, what happened in Detroit was the first mayoral election where you actually had African-Americans running for mayor was when Coleman Young came in. Mm-hmm. And that's when the racial tension really started. He ran against Nichols, who was the police commissioner at that time. And the tension between the police department, I'm skipping a lot because so much happened during those years, was very tough. Police had a specialized unit called STRESS. It stood for Stop the Robbers in George Safe Streets. And what this was, they had two different crews. Unbelievable in the 60s, nobody believes it, black and white officers didn't work together.
And this is with the Detroit police, not the Wayne State Police, right? The Wayne State Police was very small at this point.
Very small. I think we only had two black officers when I started. Myself and the guy who's my captain now. You know. Huh. And Detroit, black and white officers didn't really work together. It's always three officers assigned to a car. Mm-hmm. So when one's off, you still have two people. And they had a unit called STRESS. And you had these five or six white guys that they would call going on the stroll. And for example, it's almost a precursor to what I do now in terms of a CompStat meeting, where I look at for hot spots. Mm-hmm. Every 2 weeks I have a meeting here and I bring all these different agencies in and we look at the stats. If I see this area has 8 robberies, this area has these car thefts, then I divide tactics to bring those areas down. What STRESS did, they picked the area of Detroit, a very poor area, let's say Grand River near the Axel Ford Freeway at that time. They'll take one guy, he'll get a gas can, and he'll walk around looking like I'm looking for a gas station and ran out of gas. And he'll have a couple dollars sticking out of his pocket. And across the street a half a block down, there'd be a guy following him, a police officer. On this side, there'd be a guy following him. And in front, it's called a point. There'd be another guy walking. And it'll be followed by a car. Then once somebody approaches this guy with the gas can to rob him, they will light him up with bullets. They must have had about 12 deaths. They shot, they killed so many people. Now they weren't, I'm not saying they did it unjustly, but they used fatal force when they were going to be robbed.
So the idea was to lure a robber and then...
They go to catch the robber.
And then shoot.
Well, they shot a lot of people.
Okay.
They shot a lot of people. And Coleman Young campaigned against this. He says, I will stop it. I mean, they would shoot someone that couldn't find the weapons and would plant a weapon on them. You know, a couple of them got convicted because they planted a knife on a guy and we didn't have it. It's a very dangerous work to go out there as a decoy.
Sure, I'm sure. Yeah.
Very, very dangerous work. I mean, Vice have done it for years. Mm-hmm. But these guys went into the real rough area. They would go into the projects, like the Jeffrey Projects. Mm-hmm. That's a tough area. If you didn't, when I was coming up, if you didn't live there, you didn't walk through there.
And these are the areas that they would target as the most dangerous.
Most dangerous.
Hmm.
Even as a kid, you did not walk through the Jeffrey Projects if you didn't live there.
Was it seen as a successful program?
It was successful because no one wanted to rob anybody white in the area because that's cop.
But they only the only groups that did this were the white officers.
Man, what happened is the black officers or the white officers got into a shootout with a STRESS team. The black STRESS team was having a party one day, and the white officer saw one of the black officers walking with a gun, not knowing he was an officer. And they went into the apartment. It was a shootout and involved the two STRESS teams. It was something.
That's incredible.
Yeah, that was something. And then, you know, during that time, we had the Republic of New Africa. That was run by probably a tremendous, famous civil rights attorney. He's still practicing, Milton Henry. And it's Milton Henry and his brother, Richard Henry. Richard Henry took an African name, which I can't think of. And they had this organization called Republic of the New Africa. And what they wanted, they demanded that the governors gives them 3 or 4 states as their own country in the South. I mean, these are outrageous demands, weren't going to happen. But they had a meeting, I don't know if you call it a convention or whatever it was, in Detroit at New Bethel's Church on Linwood. And New Bethel Church is where Aretha Franklin's father, the Reverend C.L. Franklin, was a minister. Very popular, flamboyant minister. And Aretha sung there. It'd be packed, very exciting type of church. And he allowed them to have their meeting there. And Republican New Africa, they would carry guns. They had rifles, and they were in the church. And a Detroit police officer saw them with the rifle and went in. It was a shootout in the church.
When was this?
1969, 68, 70, right in that part.
So while you were still in school,
And they went in there and they shot up the church. Police officer died. And this is where George Crockett came in the police station, because he says, you never see a church in America the police will storm like that. Church was always a sanctuary where you could go and nobody would come in. Mm-hmm. And that's another reason why I need, that's when they started recruiting black police officers. So you guys, if you want to make a difference, you need to join the force and make a difference. Now, Detroit had very few black police officers. Coleman Young became mayor, and that's, to me, where the racial tension started. He changed the structure of the police department and city government overnight. Whereas before, if you applied for, I think I applied for the Detroit Police Department the first time while I was in college, but I was too young, you had to be 21. But if you had your wisdom tooth in, they wouldn't accept you if you were black.
If you had your wisdom
tooth? Yeah, they were finding all sorts of reasons not to get you in.
No kidding.
Yeah. I noticed one guy, he says, no, they told me I had my wisdom tooth, I couldn't get in. And one guy had broke his finger in one time, it didn't heal completely straight, but there's no disability. They were rejecting people left and right. You just couldn't get hurt.
And the wisdom teeth, do you think that's a class division?
No, they just found any reason not to hire you. Just any reason not to hire you.
And that was in the books.
They wouldn't hire you. You couldn't get past it. Coleman Young changed that overnight.
What other ways do you think, as far as the aims of the Detroit police? What else has changed? Hiring more black officers?
I think the education level, the training, the professionalism, it was none of that before.
Yeah.
In the 60s, it was ran by fear. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming it was very good officers and leaders who came out of that. But they ran by fear.
Right. It sounds like the stress program sounds
stress
like
was a, terror. It could have been a great program if it was controlled and managed correctly. It's forms of that today. I do a form of it today. Mm. But we have never had a fatality or a shooting at Wayne State. Mm-hmm. You have to, everything starts at the top, it goes down. The police commissioner during the civil upheaval at that time was Ray Girardin. He was the press secretary to Mayor Kavanaugh, who made him the police chief. Mm. He knew nothing about it. But now all this has changed professionally. The education level, I don't think you'll see a chief anywhere in the country who don't have advanced degrees at this time.
Yeah.
The training level, there are commissions that can actually control the certified police officers. You had none of that back then. Mm-hmm. There weren't even radios or call boxes. Mm-hmm. So, and you had beat officers. The whole thing changed today. It's completely changed.
And Wayne State's police force has changed. As you said, there were only a few officers.
I think it was 3 black officers when I got hired.
How many officers total?
Even when I became chief in 2008, we only had 23 officers.
Yeah.
I got 65 now. I'll hit 100 eventually.
No kidding.
But we had a defined area that we patrolled on the campus, around the campus. Mm-hmm. But these were very professional guys. Nobody really retired here. Guys usually worked here 3 to 4 years. They go off and become chiefs of small departments, other departments. The racism, I had no idea would be this high.
And it is now. You can get it if you need to.
Oh my God, what time is it? I forgot that. Oops. Hey, Mary, I'm sending somebody over there now. Not a problem. Not a problem. Gotta make a short detour.
No, that's okay. Do you want me to grab you a bottle of water?
Yeah, which one is it here?
Thank you for the water, by the way.
Yeah, dear, who's the OIC today? Will you ask Sergeant Zarif to call me right away? Thank you, on my cell phone. You know, I joined Wayne, and it was professional in how to, there's a lot of training, how the officers conduct themselves, but it was not a lot of opportunities for the three African-American officers. I think I was the first officer to go into a plainclothes assignment as an African-American, first one to make sergeant. But you know, it's just, we had a chief and he just was not open to anything proactive. He had a great reputation and he built a department with this 90-second response time, mm-hmm. and a great reputation. But actually I had to go outside the department to actually have people help me get promoted here. And you know, it changed gradually and we started hiring more African-American officers, but you know, there was a degree requirement that mm-hmm. eliminated a lot of people at that time.
And you've worked under six different chiefs, right? I mean, since
I only worked under two different chiefs in Wayne State. One chief stayed here, he became chief in 1969, he stayed until 2008.
Go ahead.
Hey, Dave, can you go over to the president's lot and pick up the provost? Do you know who she is? Yeah, real short. If you'll take her over to the DSO, and she might call for a ride back at 7:30 if you could let dispatch know. And she's ready now. Thank you. Yeah, we had one chief, the longest serving chief in the state. Mm. He stayed, and when he left, they hired someone from outside the department who was a captain with the state police. His name was Bill King, African-American guy, became chief for 2 years. He really was very progressive. He bought an outside, I was a lieutenant at that time. Mm-hmm. They bought an outside company out here to do an assessment center, a testing for chief. And he said, this is the method we're going to use. And I wanted to learn how that works. So I paid to go to New York to have this company take me through this process. So when I came back here to do the testing, I was so familiar with it, I came out number one. And I became the captain. And I was in charge of the line operation. Really, when you're the captain here, you're in charge of the operation department. And I just started working 18 hours a day, making changes. We never had a relationship with Detroit police. I established that. I established relationships with the neighborhoods. And he left to go to Florida International University. They usually do a national search for a chief, but the president at that time made me interim chief. Then a short time later, I became chief. And I was able to really, now I could shape the department the way I wanted it to go.
So the real advancement, it seems, I mean, the advancement as far as, you know, for African Americans in the department seems to have come from you, like, being self-motivated.
No, I was the first lieutenant. Mm-hmm. There was no other lieutenant. And once I became chief, my recruiting, everything changed. Mm-hmm. I went out and recruited females. I wanted Chinese officers. I wanted Hispanic officers. but I didn't do, say, what Coleman Young did. Coleman Young basically hired anybody who came through the door.
Right.
In fact, their first group he hired, 20 of them got fired because they were on social welfare still collecting the checks as officers. He didn't really like police when he was the mayor of Detroit. He didn't think it took much to be that. So he just really just started hiring African American. I never short-circuit the system here. Mm-hmm. What I did is I widened the pool of applicants so you could find qualified applicants. I did not accept that you couldn't find qualified African-American officers because you needed a degree. That's just unacceptable mm-hmm. to me.
And the officers that you have hired, the force has obviously grown a whole
We're
lot
60
since
officers
you started.
Now. I've tripled the size.
Right, and not just in numbers, but in successes as well.
Question about it. We went from a campus police department to a full-fledged midtown mm-hmm. police department.
And you've seen not only success, but a great number of awards in the last couple of years.
We were in the New York Times. Mm-hmm. We're in the Collegian Journal, and you just don't see police officers in that journal there. But what we're doing in the neighborhoods.
Yeah. What are you doing to empower your officers to get such good work done so consistently?
You know, I still work 18 hours a day. You know, every incident that happens, mm-hmm. I get called that I know about. I know Thursday we had a student in Old Main. That someone was in the classroom who was not a student, he got her phone number, he's stalking her. We've been following her, we're setting up a meet Thursday night, we're gonna arrest him. I mean, we just jump into it like that. Mm-hmm. What I did is I created a CompStat model where every Wednesday, it'll be like next Wednesday, we'll meet in my multi-purpose room, and I'll have every security agent, community groups, and different police agency meet. And everything is statistic. I have every crime that happens in Midtown, the Wayne State, the neighborhoods. I could tell you what happened at 8 Mile and Van Dyke.
Now that includes community organizations that are volunteer organizations as
yeah,
well.
I bring them in because Detroit Police have a CompStat. CompStat started by Bill Bratton, who was a police commissioner in New York. And theirs is a very tough CompStat. They call their command officers in and says, how come you had 8 armed robberies in your district? What are you doing about it? They put them on the spot. Don't come back here next week with 8 robberies. Mm-hmm. I don't do it that way. We do the stats. I see what all the crime is for the last 14 days. I see what the pattern, what time the crime is. I get an MO, what's the description of the people make during the crime. And from that I have a pattern. Then I have the community groups in because who better know what's going on in the neighborhood than them? And we all participate. I don't sit at the head of the table, I sit in the middle. And I want people to jump in and then I want to back out like I might be in the room. And I'll tell the command officer, well, what do you think we need to do? He says, well, I need to have 3 plainclothes guys. I says, okay, I'll give you overtime to do that. I got an undercover van, you can take that out. I got people in the community that says, look, we're going to organize a community to start looking out the windows. We'll set up a phone line to start calling you. And you'd be stunned how successful that is. The first week we started CompStat, well, since we started CompStat in 2009, we dropped the crime 50% in the Midtown area.
50.
Unheard of. Mm-hmm. We had 6 robberies on Woodward Avenue the first week we started. After we did CompStat, we made 3 arrests. We had none. I put officers walking the beat at Woodbridge. I got calls from residents saying they almost passed out. They never saw that before. But I give the officers what they need. I have cameras. I can see you drive across the Ambassador Bridge right now.
Now, as far as, a lot of that is off Wayne State's campus.
Let me tell you, the last 14 days we made in a central district of Detroit, which includes Midtown, Woodbridge, the Cultural Center, there were 52 arrests in the last 14 days. Wayne State made 45 of those arrests, and none of those arrests were campus-related. None.
Now, how is your relationship with the Detroit Chief of Police? Is there a stepping on toes issue?
It depends who the chief is. This chief I have to be very careful of. The other chief, he was here more than... He was at his police headquarters. Mm-hmm. That's how good the relationship was. Now, Detroit police come to my CompStat. I go to their Comstat. Mm-hmm. We just had de-electricity in the area. We brought 94,000 people in this area. We did not have one incident. We're going to do Noel night in November. We'll bring maybe 150,000 people. Mm-hmm. And I'll mobilize the whole department. Everybody works, including myself in uniform. This Detroit, I make sure to let him know that he's the chief of the city. And I run Wayne State. He commissions all my officers as Detroit police officers. Mm-hmm. So I have to keep that relationship good. The average precinct should put out 6 cars a night to patrol. The Central District on Wentworth and Boulevard, he might have 3. I asked, well, I put the 8 out, how come you only have 3? He says, because you guys drive the stats down. And my command structure says, you don't need it. Your stats are low. But my stats are low because of what you guys are doing. What happened is, when I became chief in 2008, we would spend 81% of our time on the campus, 21% off campus. Now we spend 65% of our time off campus and maybe 38 on campus. And what happened is the crime on campus actually went down. Mm-hmm. Because if you put a big perimeter around the area, it cuts down. For example, before Whole Foods opened, there was the old butcher shop on Woodward Avenue.
Right.
Really a great concept. Mm-hmm. I knew those guys from the 70s when they were at Lafayette Park.
Sure.
And when he first opened, he says, I'm going to have any bars on my window. It's going to be all glass. He got broken into the first 3 weeks, 14
That's right.
times. That's not even in my area. That's a Charlotte or Woodward Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
He called me and says, please help. I put a bait car out there. And the bait cars have cameras all over it.
Right.
And I put a plainclothes unit in another van. And the bait car picked up the guy, breaking into the butcher shop. He went across the street to the Coney Island to sell what he had, and we arrested him when he came out. And what he said was, he broke into 12 businesses on Woodward Avenue. He's still in prison today for that.
When was the arrest?
This was 2 years ago.
Yeah.
He says, what I did, he says, I would break the window. Then I would go sit down and see if any patrol cars coming. I thought I was out of the Wayne State area. He says, wherever I went close to Wayne State, I break in, grab anything, because you guys responsive so quick. And we get a lot of community support when we made that arrest there.
Mm-hmm.
And in Detroit, if you have an alarm in your house or in your business, Detroit would only respond if you could verify that it's a good alarm. That doesn't make any sense to me. You're paying money for an alarm. You're paying taxes for police protection. And if your house gets broken into or your business, the alarm company calls 911. The 911 says, you have to tell us if it's a good alarm.
Right.
How do you do that? You call the owner or the resident and say, you got to go home and tell me if somebody's in there. So the owner goes home and the business person does. He said, yeah, they broke in. And then the 911 operator says, okay, you can make the report over the phone. So what happens now, everybody calls me on Woodward Avenue. We respond in 90 seconds. We get an alarm, we go.
Mm-hmm.
And I told the New York Times reporter, just go down Woodward Avenue, ask any business person who you call.
Mm-hmm.
Go into the Starbucks and Mac at Woodward and says, I need the police. We'll be calling right.
When I started teaching here, it's the first thing someone told me is if you have an emergency, don't bother calling 911.
Even not even an emergency. If you can't get into your car, you got a flat tire. We do a lot of safe walks now. Mm-hmm. Not just for the university, it sort of spreads. I have seniors who still live in the Jeffrey Projects. It's just only the senior high rise still there because they refuse to move.
Mm-hmm.
The city says, we're going to tear them down and build nice townhouses for you. They say, oh, no, no, no. And on the 3rd of the month, when they walk to the bank, we got a scout car here, a scout car here. We're watching them do that.
Mm-hmm.
I got cameras on the ATM machines. If I see a guy hanging around, the car's going to pull right up.
So you're monitoring through cameras areas outside of Wayne State?
Oh, I can see Cobo Hall. I can see you walk into the front door of MGM Casino with my cameras.
No kidding.
Yeah. If you pick up a phone on campus and you call me, I'm looking at you.
One of the, you mean one of the outdoor phones? Or?
Yeah.
Wow.
Even if you call me on your cell phone from Castle Warren, mm-hmm. and you say, I'm at Castle Warren, we'll say, I'm looking at you. Mm-hmm. And that sort of really helps. And we don't use the cameras for recording. We use it for patrol. I'm not interested in what happened yesterday to look it up. I'm interested in what happens right now so I can stop it before it happens.
Out of all of the things that you've done here, you know, all of these changes that you've made, not just in your role as chief, but in the whole time that you've been at Wayne State, what do you consider your greatest accomplishments or additions to what's happening here?
I think my greatest accomplishment to me is my relationship to people who live in the area. Mm. I think that's been the greatest thing for me. Well, as an officer, I could park my car in those early years and I could walk through the projects. Mm. And nobody cursed me out, nobody wanted to jump me. I had that type of relationship. I can remember chasing a stolen car and the guys get out and start running. I'm a slow runner and I'm chasing them and the community is joining in with me. And they caught the guys for me. That type of relationship, to me means a lot. I mean, I could, while I was working midnights for 12 years, I could stop people on the street, prostitutes, and say, well, this guy's breaking into cars, and they would tell me who it is. They would actually call me and say, hey, this guy you're looking for is out. You know? And I would send a lot of them to rehab and say, hey, you got to get off the street. This is going to kill you. And I think how I related to people and opened up relationships with Detroit, with all the resistance that I had. Because that was considered a weakness when I started with you, dealing with the community like that.
Well, that's something, I earlier you were talking about your background in psychology. You know, you got your degree in psychology. And I know that you've done a lot of work with the Wayne State Police Force in training your officers to recognize the difference between criminals and people that need help.
Dennis, so crucial, because see what happened when England was governor, he closed all the mental health facilities. Mm-hmm. When I started, and you saw a person who's a danger to himself or someone else, we would take him to the crisis center. And the crisis center would hold him for observation for 72 hours. After that 72 hours, we would go to probate court. And a judge would look at the petition and either confine him to a mental health institution like Northville, Lafayette Clinic. There were like 10 of them. Mm-hmm. And this person actually got help. I see this guy, Derek Tony, who I took to the crisis center in 1981. He went to the Detroit Institute of Arts on the outdoor statues to start painting it. And I got to call someone defacing the statue. And he was off his meds. He was a big guy. We fought. You know, I got him cuffed. Took him to the crisis center. I went to probate court. And I see him now. He's still on medication, but he's a very functional citizen. And actually, every time I got promoted, I got a postcard from this guy. Congratulations. I mean, that's a heck of a thing right there.
That's incredible.
And when England closed that, his theory was good. He was saying, let's put the mental health people back in the community that they're from. Let's open up shelters or community houses. But what happened was that became a get rich scheme. These guys would get a house, get all these people in, get checks from the state. They got no treatment, no medicine, no nothing. So all these people on the street. I would say 70% of the homeless had psychological issues. Detroit, what, 5 years ago, shot a guy who had psychological issues, who's deaf, because he had a rake. He didn't understand anything. He couldn't hear you. They shot and killed him. Now, they were being threatened. I mean, I don't really blame the officer. But if you're sick, it's not a crime. If you're homeless, it's not a crime. Mm-hmm. So we need a training in this. So I went with the mental health department of the city and the School of Social Work. I said, can you give me a mental health worker? I'm going to give you a team of officers for you to train. And would you ride with them once a week? And we're going to look for the chronic homeless, and we're going to look for those with mental health issues, and will you show us how to approach them? It's still a work in progress.
And are all of your officers getting that kind of training?
I have a select group who I want to be specialists. but officers are getting that training. Because we have certain people on campus, like Mary. She wears all these overcoats, and she sits on the bench. Now, 2 years ago, I had her placed in a facility up north, but she's back. But now, we know how to deal with her. We don't threaten her or get her off campus. Because the big issue with Detroit was that you're driving crime off campus, but you're just sending them downtown, or you're sending them north in the Boston-Addison area. So they're real angry with us. So now we don't just tell the homeless, don't be in this corner. We try to take them to a shelter. The problem is the shelter, NSO on 3rd, they don't want to go there because it's unsafe. They want to sleep and hang on campus. And the students have big hearts. Students are hiding them in business, give them money, bring them clothes.
Yeah, it's true.
So I have to do sweeps at night at some of the buildings, and I'll find them.
And that's got to be a very tough position for your officers as well, knowing that they make Wayne State the safest place to be. And if these people are suffering from mental illness...
But the issue is the Wayne State is an educational facility where students need... They pay money to go here, and it's an academic environment, and they can't have these kind of interruptions.
Absolutely. No, that's tough.
You know, so it's a... It's a constant battle, because there's not any place you can really take them right now.
Right. Well, I've seen your officers respond to those, you know, to mental health issues on campus. Yeah. And they do seem, and I've read in a couple articles about your police force as well, that they do have a focus on
getting
people to the right
place. I think
if
we didn't, you would see a lot of fatalities. We don't really get a lot of citizen complaints. We get some because of how we respond. Because with one-man cars, if you call and you have an argument, maybe three cars will show up. Now, that might look like overkill. But what it does is that it prevents the situation from escalating. You know, if a guy is arguing or threatening his wife or his girlfriend, and we pull up with four officers, he's not going to fight four guys. He just can't win that, no matter how big or how good he is. But it creates some type of racial atmosphere where they say we're profiling. I get that quite a bit. We pull a car over traffic, another car pull up behind them, and the person said, well, I blew a red light, so I get two police cars here? Go find a dope dealer. But it's a safety issue. None of our officers have been hurt. The citizen is not hurt. Usually when they come in to make a complaint, I'll bring them up to my office, and I will explain the situation to them. Sometimes they leave good, sometimes they don't. But the fact that we've never been involved in a fatal shooting, no one's been fatally injured, to me, that's the kind of goal I want.
Never? No fatal shootings?
Never. Never have. And we have all sorts of equipment.
And do you think that Wayne State's benefit to the greater Detroit community...
They'll tell you that. They'll tell you. I don't know if the university knows it, but when the university was going through layoffs at the last budget cut, and every department had to give up something, I had over 1,000 letters wrote to the president's office from community people. And not only that, I get letters from the Jefferson District in Lafayette Park asking the president, can we patrol there? Brush Park. How come Wayne State can't patrol there? I have increased my boundaries. Unbelievable. Whether it's a baseball game or a football game, I have officers at Brush Park. Because people park there to become targets. You know, I get this all the time. I got a call from a citizen, how come you can't come to the bus terminal downtown? We have to get off the bus there.
Do you think as you plan on expanding, you said you'd like to get, you know, over 100.
I need 100 officers to stay where I'm at now to do a better job. I think if I try to expand the reach any longer, any further out, I don't think I would be effective. I don't think it would be fair to the university because I don't get any outside funding.
What do you think, do you think that what you've done here, the changes that you've made and the successes that you've had, do you think those could be applied or, you know, transferred to the greater Detroit Police Force?
You know, it's kind of funny you said it. Other agencies come in, Lansing, Flint, Pontiac, and look at our model and put it in effect. But, you know, police work is very close. It's very territorial. is very ego driven. And when Ken Cockrell was mayor of Detroit, he was the interim mayor for a while. He interviewed me for the chief position. And I told him, this guy you have as your deputy chief would be a much better candidate, because you're not going to get 3,000 officers to buy in if you're hiring a police chief from a university with 60 officers to run a 3,000 person department. You're not going to get that buy-in. And you have an election coming up, and I'm the last thing that you need to bring on the table. And it can be applied, but Detroit needs resources. Mm. You got to have feet on the ground. The most thing, when somebody calls, you have to be there. And it's very, very political. Mm-hmm. Detroit has come and looked at my model, but the problem is when you get headlines, you get papers saying how good you are, sometimes it creates friction.
Sure.
Then I have to find a better way that doesn't happen. I've basically been refusing interviews the last couple of weeks. Was like Channel 4 is doing something on the bait cars. And I really, this should be running this week. I'm almost sorry I did that. Because I don't want Detroit to say, well, here they come again.
Yeah,
I want to be part of the team. I don't want to be captain of the team. I just want to be on a team where we're all working together.
Sure.
The Illich Corporation is approaching us with the new stadium going down there. Mm. Quicken Loans, Dan Gilbert's people, says, we'll pay you to patrol downtown. But I have an agreement with Detroit that I won't accept money to patrol out of the area, because he'll say, wait a minute, give us the money.
Hmm.
So it's a very political tightrope you have to be very careful of.
Sure.
I did accept the $150,000 for 1 year for the Center for Creative Studies, which means I'll respond to anything that they have down there.
Mm-hmm.
Officers walk through their buildings. We conduct crime prevention, RAD training. But other than that, you know, I told Quicken Loans we will assist on big events down there. We'll be like Winter Blast. We'll have our officers down there. The Thanksgiving Parade will be down there. But it's just a very tight political tightrope. And then a board of governors at the university, I don't think they quite know everything we do. Because someone's going to ask the question, well, why are you out there doing that? So I have to be, I can justify it now. Like going out there, I keep the crime low here. And we are encouraging our students to live all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got students who say, I live in Lafayette Park, my car broken into and Detroit won't come. Or I got students who says, I went to the Tiger ball game, I had too much to drink, I can't find my car. Well, we'll go down there.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah.
But eventually the board will say, well, you know what? We really can't fund you to do all of that.
But you think for the time being, the work you do is still focused on the students and the university and the student community?
You know what? I would call it the university community.
Mm-hmm.
And the university community, when I go out for talks to the neighborhoods, I says, you're part of the university community.
Mm-hmm.
I said, maybe no one in this group here goes to the university, has a kid there, but you live within our vision, our eyesight, that you're part of the community. And you're... your success is my success. When you fail, I fail. And that's a tie-in to the university.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Corktown says, can you come down here? Well, I can't do that. But I call Detroit police. I says, Slow's Barbecue on the weekend might have fire cars broken into because they park on the service drive. If you want me to assist you, I'm going to put two plainclothes cars down here. We're going to sit and try to catch the guys. Detroit said, that's great, I'll give you one car.
Mm-hmm.
So when we make the arrest, I let Detroit say they did it.
Mm-hmm.
It works out. You see, the key is the guy who breaks into a car at Corktown is the same guy that's going to come down here and break into a car.
Mm-hmm.
They don't stop and says, I'm only doing a Corktown. They're going to ride around all night and look for opportunity.
Sure.
The guy who carjacks a guy on Jefferson and Shane is the same guy who's going to come to Woodward Forest and carjack somebody.
Mm-hmm.
So the bad guy is a bad guy no matter where he's at. I started a program, to me has been very successful. I looked at all the people we arrested, and 80% of them had Department of Correction history, which either meant they've been in prison, they've they on parole or they off parole, but they have a history of corrections. So I went to the Department of Correction, and the deputy director says, "Kid, I'd like to try a pilot." He's very apprehensive. I says, "I know that you have parole officers, and their job is to do home visits. They're supposed to go knock on the door of these multi-dwelling apartments and says, okay, Mr. Johnson, where are you working? I need to take a urine sample. I need to look through your apartment to make sure you have no weapons. Who's this person in here? I need to check them to make sure they're not a felon." Do they do that? Absolutely not. Would you do that if you were by yourself? I wouldn't. They're going to write it down, just like a salesperson for Xerox. He's supposed to do 20 cold calls a day when he just knocks on the door. He goes to a phone book and writes down these places, does it go? So I says, "If you would assign an agent to our station, I'm going to give her or him an office, computer, let them work out of my station, and when it's time for home visits, I'll send three people with her or him." So that's what we do twice a month. You'd be surprised. Now she goes in, she knocks on the door. Instead of this guy has an attitude, she opens the door, it's three guys with her. Mm-hmm. She gets a urine sample, she searches the apartment. You'd be surprised how many arrests we made.
No kidding.
Unbelievable.
And that's all right here.
We go right here, we pick an area in Midtown. She has an office right at my station. Her name is Michelle Lopez. She's here every day. People on parole come here to see her. And this sends them a message. I'm not dealing with just one person. Now this whole agency knows me. And what we do also, like if I have, one time we have what we call apple picking. That's when you're on your cell phone and someone comes and snatches it. So we had like six in a 2-week period. So I went to the Department of Correction and says, "You know, I can't solve this. I can't catch the guy. Do you have anybody who's on a tether in this 8-block area? Can you show me who's on a tether at between 9 o'clock at night and 1 in the morning who's been in this area?" Unbelievable. Every robbery we had, somebody on a tether was there. So we looked that up. And we find a guy lives on Willis. He works at the Whitney. And we followed him while he committed a robbery.
No kidding.
We chased him. We let him run back to his apartment. We went in, we arrested him, got a search warrant, and got him convicted. That's what that collaboration and partnership does for you.
Right.
When you work as a team. So I told Detroit, I says, "Let me assign two officers to you to work your carjacking team." They say, "Well, do better than this. Give us a sergeant and let him run a squad for us." So I got two officers assigned to the Detroit police squads. They don't even come here. They work there every day. I got two officers assigned to ATF, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. I got another officer assigned out to the FBI Violent Crime Task Force. So now they know who we are, and the Board of Governors said, "Well, what's the advantage for us?" Well, on Milwaukee, on Baltimore, and Wartwood Avenue, where the White Castle is, there was a house, it was a big prostitution house opening up across the street. Students were living in Loss down the street. They says, "We can't walk down there." I send ATF in there, the two officers had undercover, and we did a raid, and we arrested 45 people in there. We closed it down. It's a senior citizen place on Simpson and Wartwood Avenue, Orchestra Hall, and the drug dealers took it over. We moved an officer in there for 6 months. He lived there. He made so many purchases, we got 130 arrest warrants, and we did a big raid that was coordinated with the Wayne County Sheriff's, ATF, had all the news media there. It's been very effective for us. This is right across the street from the Bonsdale.
And that's all through coordination with Detroit
other agencies.
Police.
Oh. Detroit really wasn't involved FBI. With this one. It was the ATF, Alcohol, ATF. Tobacco, and Firearms, the FBI, Violent Crime Task Force, and Wayne County Sheriff's.
That's incredible. And so you partner with major organizations as well as community organizations and just put feelers out through.
The major organizations, they hire my officers. The ATF, they hire both of these officers that I assigned there.
No kidding.
So I'm going to give them three more officers. I know I'm going to lose those officers, but that's great. I want people to do well. I want them to grow.
Now, your officers, are you hiring out of the Wayne State I hired Nationwide. Department, right?
No.
Oh, no, you're not.
I hired Nationwide.
And I know that you have cadets from right. the...
I hired criminal justice. I hired cadets.
Yeah.
And...
So they get experience on the job through the Criminal Justice Department while they're working on their bachelor's degree, and then
right.
they go elsewhere for...
Well, they apply here. Most of them do. And the problem with being a cadet, it can either help you or hurt you. I have to keep in mind that they're young, they're students. But if they screw up or mess around, then it hurts the job. You know, I had some cadets who got too aggressive meeting the females. And, you know, if I tell you to do a safe walk, I don't want you to pick the girl up. I want you to do a safe walk. I don't want you to try to get a date.
I should think not.
So, you know, I have to dismiss you or something like that. And it's going to hurt you getting a job here anywhere else because police do backgrounds, and I tell them that.
Mm-hmm.
I've hired quite a few cadets who've done a good job.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do a bad job, you know, I don't want you going to arrest people. I want you to be the eyes and ears.
Mm-hmm.
You're supposed to walk around campus. If you see somebody, you call us. But, you know, it's a learning experience. It can help you get a job or it can hurt you get a job.
Yeah. And do you think... that encouraging those young cadets. You mentioned when we first started, you were talking about, you know, your parents urging you to succeed so early on. You think that comes out of that?
I think so. I mean, I hire a lot of Wayne State football players,
mm-hmm.
criminal justice, and we look out for the athletes. When they get in trouble, you know, they come to me and we have a conversation with them. In terms of this could kill you or this could hurt your career. Joyke Bell, that plays for the Lion, was a cadet here. And I constantly sort of mentored him about fame. Some of these athletes have kids right out of high school. I said, these domestic violence cases, when you argue with your kid's mother, it's going to hurt you for years to come. I have this rule. We have a charter school right here. We have another one down the street. We have another on the east side. And they all come on campus. Most of the schools let them out, and they stay on campus for the parents to pick them up.
Mm-hmm.
So when they get in fights, the charter schools, instead of the police getting them, they have to come up and see me.
Hmm.
And I bring them in this room here, the two people fighting. I have a pizza. They eat pizza. They drink pop. That's what this was for yesterday. Two kids got in a fight. And they said, what's going to happen? I said, well, this is what's going to happen. I give them each a book that says, in 3 weeks, you're going to come to the station, you're going to give me an oral report of this book you read. They're laughing. And I let them go. But when they go to school the next day, I'm there. I already talked to the principal. I walk in the classroom, and I embarrass them in front of the whole class. Says, Robert got in a fight on campus. He's going to give her a book report. In my station, on this day, that you guys are all invited. Then I go to the house. And sometimes the parents help me and I says, does he have an Xbox? And he says, I like to take it. And he'll get it back when the report's done.
That is incredibly hands-on.
And then when they come in to do the report, they think they're coming in here, they go into my multi-purpose room, I have 60, 70 people in. I have police officers, I have judges, I have teachers, and I brief them. I says, when you finish, I want everybody to scream just like he won the Pulitzer Prize. And when he finished, it's the worst report, oral report I ever heard of my life. But everybody's high-fiving him, jumping up.
Mm.
And he said to me, was it that good? I said, it was terrible. It was the worst I've ever heard, but they were applauding the potential you could have. And, you know, now I got interns from this school who come to the station. But, you know, you have to think out of the box. With kids, every time they have a fight, if you grab them, you rough them up, you write them a ticket, you call the parents, and say, you're not really doing that much. You got to find something different to do. And these are young elementary school kids. You know, first the university administrator says, let's kick them off campus, don't want them here. I says, hey, do we really want to do that? We don't want them to interfere with the process of people studying to go to school because it's very serious. School is expensive. But you cannot make them feel unwelcome.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a tough balance. And for me to get everybody to buy in is not easy. But these are just pollens I try. You know, I might review this at the end of 6 months if that's successful.
Have you gone back and visited? I mean, that student, do you think that was successful?
Two cases I did was very successful.
Yeah. It's an interesting idea. I mean, you know, not because punishing students for fighting by being negative towards negativity.
Yeah, no, you got to give me a report. Yeah. At the end of the report, it's going to turn out very positive.
That's very interesting.
It's just a different concept I'm trying here.
Well, it seems like it's in miniature a lot of what you're doing in the city. You know,
we had one guy who we constantly were arrested for criminal trespass. I says, why are you always here? You're not a student. And then I says, look, why don't you go down and apply to become a student? Well, he couldn't get in here, but he got into Wayne County community, and now he's here now. He transferred to student.
And he's here now going
he's
to
here.
School. That's true.
I see him. I says, see? We used to lock you up every day.
For trespassing.
Trespassing. We warn you of criminal trespass, that means you cannot be on the campus. You're supposed to be doing something that's disruptive.
Right.
The homeless people are pretty smart. They all know now to get a backpack. So they look like a student. We can't pick them out. You know?
Right. That's great. And now he actually is a
He
student.
Went to Wayne County. You know, Wayne County has an open door policy.
Right.
You do have to have a high school diploma to get in.
Huh.
But you do the work after 2 years, he applied here, he got financial aid.
It's fantastic.
He stops by the station. You know, he says, hey, I'm going to have your job. I said, I hope you do.
And he might.
I hope you do.
I think that's a wonderful note to end on, actually.
Yeah, we get that. You know, we get some negative, but there's some positive what makes it worthwhile.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Well, it's an incredible way to turn something around.
Yeah. It's such a large city and large organization, you're not going to. You can't be that hands-on and do a lot of that. Mm-hmm. But in my job, I think I can still do that.
Well, you grow the department too much. You might not.
I hear something on the radio, I'm going out there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm at home, my radio's on. I hear the officers involved in something. I'm leaving home, I'm coming out here. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, you're doing fantastic.
Well, we're working on it.
Yeah.
This job, you're one incident away from failure, you know.
Oh, I think you have a few steps down before.
Yeah, you know, you like the law school student. That happened, it was very devastating.
Yeah, it was.
You know, even though we know who did it, we know it didn't happen on campus, but until you can make that arrest and prove it, then it still lingers.
Yeah.
And it really hurts us because, see, university is losing enrollment because of the appearance of crime in the city.
Yeah, well, I thought last year was my second year at the university, and I thought it really said something about how low the crime rate actually is on campus.
Well, it's lower than Bloomfield.
I mean, the death of a student was that shocking.
It was.
I mean, it was so devastating to the entire campus, even though it happened.
I mean, national news.
Right. And people talk about Detroit like it's this.
Yeah, because what happens if you hear a shooting where three people and a two-year-old got shot on 7 Mile and Van Dyke. Parents in the suburbs with kids are not making the distinction that that's nowhere near Wayne State.
Right.
We're in Detroit, so we're going to suffer for that.
Mm-hmm. No, you're absolutely right.
And I've had students who got shot and killed elsewhere, like the football player got shot downtown.
Mm-hmm.
But they do the backdrop on Wayne State where they report it.
Right.
So if you have kids, I mean, I have a son, and what I say, or I don't have a daughter. If I had a daughter, I said, do I want her to go there? That's why Macomb Community College and Oakley Community, their enrollment's just spiraling. You used to not see kids with 4.1 averages going to those junior colleges. You do now.
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of those students end up transferring here, right? I mean,
some do. Oakley University is really growing now.
Yeah.
A lot are going to Oakley University.
Mm-hmm. So. That's in this one in Rochester.
That's in Rochester,
Rochester, Michigan.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
Huh.
It's going to be a constant battle. Once the image of the city changes, I think it'll help the enrollment.
And you think it's on its way?
I think Midtown and Downtown is on its way. Mm-hmm. Do I think the neighborhoods are? They're still a forgotten segment of the population here.
Mm-hmm. Time, you think more?
Time. I mean, I give this mayor credit. He's tearing down abandoned houses and he's being responsive. But if you go to some places in the city, it's pretty devastating.
Yeah, in the neighborhoods, yeah.
And we have to change the education system. Our biggest problem that we're going to have in the years to come, we have these young professionals like yourself people going to school, living and working in Midtown. What happens when it's time to raise a family? And you'll say, where does my kid go to school? I sent my son to Cranbrook. I spent $20,000 a year for him to go to school. Now, would it make more sense to move to a nice area, the suburbs, that had a nice school system, and not spend that money? That's what they're going to have to come up with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know a lot of our professors here live in the Ann Arbor area.
There you go. I mean, when you get family and then you want your kid to be able to ride the bike where you don't have to stand on the porch and say, don't go past two houses.
Yep.
When I was a kid, you get on your bike, you ride for days.
Yeah.
We have to challenge that. We have to do something with the K-12 system here.
Mm-hmm. Make it a livable, drivable, walkable
neighborhood. You have to do it. You have to do something with the education system here. Mm-hmm. Maybe it'd be great that the mayor takes over the K-12 system.
Yeah, perhaps.
It's a wreck right now.
I know it. Yeah.
But we're lucky. Midtown has all these young professionals, so is downtown with Dan Gilbert's mm-hmm. doing it.
No, there's rapid change.
But once the family comes, you know, it's just the infrastructure, we still need a lot of work. Mm-hmm. I don't see people in the neighborhoods feel that they're forgotten and not part of this transformation yet. It hasn't got to them yet.
Mm-hmm. Yet, I think, is a key word, though.
You know, I talk stats in my Comstat. I have this big stat. And community people tell me, well, we know what's going on. We don't have to look at the stats. Mm. We know if it's safe or not safe. That's where I really like them at my meetings. Mm. The prosecutor, Kim Worthy, says, I don't want to see your stats. They don't mean anything to me. Crime is underreported. And she's right. Mm. If people are in despair, the house gets broken into, they don't have insurance, you call the police, it takes them 2 hours to come or not come at all, why do you report it?
Right.
Are they going to catch anybody? No. Mm-hmm. Do they show you any compassion when they show up? Your name, social security number, just send us a list and at this number you have it by.
Right.
What kind of compassion is that? That's why I try to show the officers here. Got to show some concern. Mm-hmm. If somebody's been robbed, they reported it a day later, put them in the car, still ride around and see if they see anybody they recognize. Put them in a car when you go to the corner store and says, do you see somebody match your description? Show them that you care.
Right.
You know.
Instead of just taking a couple notes and...
Take a couple notes, see you later.
Yeah. That's a big difference.
A big difference.
Little effort, big difference.
You know, they got to believe in you or buy into what you're doing or it won't happen.
Yeah.
That's why crime is underreported.
Yeah.
People come in the city expect the cars are going to get broken into. Mm-hmm. They say, oh, well, I'm going home.
Yep. No, you're right.
But it'll change. I mean, everything starts at the top and it goes down. Mm-hmm. So with strong leadership, I think we'll see the change.
Yeah, well, I saw that difference firsthand last year.
Good.
You know, when I had to reach out to your department myself, with I had that case with a student following me.
We still get that. That's just a big issue we're working on. So. We take it very seriously.
And he had mental health issues, and your officers took him in, got him help, got him to a hospital, and he sought treatment, and you guys made me feel safe and supported.
But we do not let them back on campus. We do a lot of persona non grata. If you do any threatening behavior, we'll give you a letter. You cannot come back on campus.
No, it all resolved, really. I was very impressed.
Good. I mean, it's just very serious matter here.
It is. Yeah.
You know, so.
Very frightening. And I felt safe. I got walked around campus by your officers, you know. It was, and everyone seemed very well informed about psychological issues, you know.
And, you know, the key that some things we can't control is like the lighting.
Mm. Oh, yes.
I mean, Cass Avenue is pitch dark. I drive by at night, I just cringe. I says, I can't even see who's walking the street.
Yeah, it is a problem.
It's a city issue at the university. They say this will all be done by the end of the year, the lighting will be here, but it's just...
I have heard that.
You know, I put a lot of requests in. I have portable lightings, but I can't get that kind of resources. I understand university gets the money from the state. I go to foundations to try to get a lot of money, but it's quite a struggle.
Now, the campus is well lit. I mean,
so I need to do something about CAS and people park all over. And,
right.
I preach safe walks, but I still can't get that many people to call.
Right. A lot of people, a lot of my students, because I taught a night class in the winter semester, and And a lot of my students kept saying, oh, I keep meaning to do that, but I don't know the numbers.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing.
And like the international students, that's another tough group to get to. Because they don't interact with police.
Right. No, you're absolutely right.
Chinese students never call you.
No kidding.
Yeah, that's why I was real happy when I hired a couple of Chinese officers to converse with. They just don't call you. They're a very focused group where they come here from another country. They're here for one reason. They get that degree and they're gone.
Also, depending on the area they come from, I mean, police
are... Police are very brutal. They do not trust police.
Mm-hmm. I look what's going on right now in Hong Kong.
Yeah, they don't. They don't like police. They don't trust police. I imagine we have quite a few of them victims of crime. They're just not going to report it.
Certainly. Yeah. Well, a lot of people from other, you know, from other nations where the police are untrustworthy.
Oh yeah, I understand. We try to break that barrier, but it's So I just tell my officers, the foreign kids will meet and they will walk in groups.
Mm-hmm.
I just tell my officers. First I said follow them, but then they become paranoid. I said, no, just now we keep an eye on them with the camera.
Right. That's a good idea. I mean, it's your job to look after them, even if they don't want to be looked after.
Absolutely.
So,
if they're a victim of crime, they're not going to court.
Mm-hmm.
Even if we catch the guy.
Right.
They're just not doing it.
Oof, it's a tough job.
Yeah, but we keep working on it.
Yeah. So. Well, thank you so much.
Okay.
For taking up a whole lot of your time.
No, not a problem at all.